Now entering Nerdist.com.
Big Pop Fun. It's time for another episode of Big Pop Fun with Tom Wilson. Join Tom as he talks to the artists, writers, performers, and personalities that affect... that he can talk into me on the show. Here's Tom.
Hello, everybody, and I'm Tom Wilson. Welcome to the Big Pop Fun with Tom Wilson podcast. Yes, I am the guy. My name is in the title. Welcome. I'm going to take you on a magical sleigh ride of entertainment and wonder through the forest of life. Okay, let's just go past that one. Hey, the Big Pop Fun with Tom Wilson podcast is brought to you by, TomWilsonUSA.com, my website. You can contact me through there. I'm traveling all over this great land of ours, entertaining the masses with fabulous things and cheese. There's not cheese. They certainly have cheese. They serve cheese at the clubs that I perform in. Cheese and a lot of chicken. Chicken wings and cheese. They have pizzas and they have beer and soft drinks. And apparently they have gigantic fish bowls that you can fill with kind of cherry candy flavored booze with long straws, and then the bowl kind of flashes disco lights. I can't even begin to figure that thing out at a comedy club, but you know, it works and people drink it, and then they're ever so entertaining to speak with after the show. Thanks so much for joining me again. I'm having a lot of fun with this, and it's entertaining me. So let's go on. Mark Hamill, number three. Yes, I'm not done with him. For those of you who haven't listened to it, I have two previous episodes talking to my buddy Mark Hamill. We did a computer game together called Wing Commander. We did an animated show called Wing Commander Academy. There are still many, many Wing Commander aficionados out there, people who are really, really into the cartoon and the game. And we had a lot of fun on the shoot. Mark's a great guy, as I've told you. But early on in the shoot, when we were first acting together, Tom went the cheap and easy route, which I had never done before. And believe me, I have never done it since. But I made a mistake because it's early in the shoot and I hadn't been around Mark a lot. And I said, he's really gracious about it. He's a terrific guy, great sense of humor, very witty. But we're in a scene together and it's Mark and I, couple of actresses or something or other, and somebody makes a mistake. It was probably me who made the mistake with a line or something. So we blew the scene, and Mark walks out of the frame of the camera. He's out of the shot, and it's that moment of silence. And I don't know why I did. I'd never done it before, but I lean to the actresses, and I say, hey, was that dude from Star Wars? Okay, it gets a chuckle from those people. It gets a little laugh from the camera people and everything. Immediately, I feel terrible. I mean, people do that to me all the time on a set. And no, I'm not rude about it. But, you know, you are trying to be in a scene. You have a lot of lines to memorize. You're trying to work on something today. And everybody has the little comment. And that day, unfortunately, I was the guy with the comment. Which, as I said, it had never happened before. It has never happened since. So, oh my gosh, it's halfway out of my mouth. And I take out, you know, the imaginary sledgehammer, and I'm continually beating myself in the head over it. But I figure, okay, that was a mistake. You don't do that to actors during a scene, and we just let that go. Months and months later, the producers, they contact me and say, oh, you know, you got to check that thing out because we're putting that little scene on that Dick Clark show, Bloopers and Practical Jokes. I said, what? Yeah, they, you know, we've checked. Well, we need, you know, PR for the games and everything. So we sent it to that Dick Clark show. It's Bloopers and Practical. So I wanted it to be buried forever. I wanted it to be nailed in a wooden box and placed right next to the Lost Ark in that giant warehouse at the end of the movie. No. A couple months later, Dick Clark, God rest his soul, Dick Clark was a terrific guy, such a positive, encouraging, nice man. I worked a couple shows with him, and a very nice guy anyway, but my stupid little comment when Tom just, got a little bit nervous, it was a little too quiet, and that funny boy thing, I should say something because I'm uncomfortable standing here. Was that dude from Star Wars? It shows up on Bloopers and Practical Jokes, and they show it again and again with Dick Clark and who's Ed McMahon saying, "Oh, those kooky actors with their little comments." So I apologize to Mark. Then I think I did. I'm pretty sure I did. If I wasn't beating my head against a cinder block wall. But the fact is, Mark is an actor of wide, actually incredibly wide experience and a very deep talent. I remember years ago seeing Mark, I think Flash Gordon was the show. He played a character named the Trickster. It might be in DVDs somewhere on that show, but he played it was so great physically, vocally, and in every way. He played a bad guy named the Trickster that even years and years ago, before I had even met him, I was impressed with that. I mean, that was good work. But as a voiceover actor as well, he does the Joker on Batman. He's now a famous voiceover actor and at the top of the voiceover industry for everyone. Everyone working with him knows how talented. And he's done more theater than his theater resume is as long as my arm. I mean, he played the Elephant Man on Broadway. If you think that's easy, hey, kids, go try it. I've always been impressed with Mark, and I like him a lot. I hope you enjoy the final segment of my conversation with Mark Hamill.
It's Big Pop Fun.
But I'll tell you in a nutshell, within 5 minutes of meeting Sam Fuller, he is so compelling, so dynamic, telling you the story of the movie. Because it wasn't like, Saving Private Ryan, where Spielberg didn't serve in the military and he can read books and interview people. This guy, it was his autobiography, really. Carradine was playing the Sam Fuller character, and he could tell me who I was playing. And, in retrospect, I learned more about the real World War II doing that experience than I did in history books.
Sure. And Lee Marvin was a veteran himself.
Absolutely. And here's what happened. I mean, so as I'm sitting there watching Sam going, he's up on his feet. He's like Yosemite Sam because he's really tiny. Oh, let me tell you, you fat butthole. You don't like that guy. You hate his guts. He's probably screwing your girlfriend. And you're like watching him. And he'd go off on tangents. I mean, he would brilliantly just weave this mystical spell of great storytelling. I didn't even get to why I didn't want to do it. I mean, I realized within 10 minutes of his monologue, I just enlisted, haven't I? Because I said, there's no way I'm not going to have the experience of making a Sam Fuller movie. Now, I get over that hump. And then I'm thinking, oh, my God, now Lee Marvin, what's he going to be like? And Sam Fuller, he's a great guy. A big cigar bigger than his head. And in a nutshell, not only was Lee Marvin just one of the greatest actors, I think, of all time, but he didn't have to be the center of attention. In other words, when I met him, I used that sort of self-deprecating humor, because he thought maybe I'm going to be so full of myself because of the space movies. And yet, I had observed him. We were sitting in an outdoor cafe. And if you tried to compliment him, it would be a barrage of obscenities. Ah, fuck, I don't shit. If you said anything that was slightly insulting to him, he loved it. I said, you have a gold record? You can't sing. I know. Isn't that great? You know? Because he got a gold record for
sure. I was born under a wandering star.
In fact, a guy wandered up in Israel and said, Mr. Marvin, I like you so much. And he's about ready to say, well, fuck you. You know, to this guy. He goes, but I have your record. I was boring under a wandering star. He got up, hugged him, made him sit down and have wine with us. So he loved that sort of stuff. One of the things that he loved about me was I'd never let him forget that he turned down Jaws.
Oh, yeah.
Robert, what's his, you know.
The, what, Roy Scheider?
No. The Quint.
Yes.
The old grizzled.
Robert Shaw.
Yeah. And he goes, what do I know? For me, it was about a man versus a big fish. You know, I mean, he didn't know who Spielberg was. But he loved the fact, you know, that I would say to him, oh, shut up. You haven't had a hit since Cat Ballou. You know, he would love that.
Yeah.
And I didn't learn that the first night. But one thing I did learn is he loves to laugh. He was a big fan of not only Saturday Night Live, but Fernwood Tonight. You've seen me on with Martin Mull and Fred Willard, where I was telling him about my latest movie was a boy that was, it was like the wild one, but I was raised by pigs. And it was real straight face, and it wasn't scripted. It was just, you know, this is what we're going to talk about. And they gave me the premise. And those guys are just gold.
Oh,
you know?
Sure.
And they're so generous. They don't have to dominate. And that's another thing about Marvin. He didn't have to dominate. Now, he's one of the best storytellers I've ever told. Not only was he in the war, but he was shot. He got up in Bet-Shan where the heat was like off the scales. It was up at 120. We had to be in the shade with, you know, the chamois with the sea breeze. People were passing out. It's in the desert. He got up and mimed how he got shot in the ass in the South Pacific, because he had done that movie with Toshiro Mifune, which really spoke to him because that's where he got it. And I'm telling you, and he's a tall guy. He's narrating. And I'm telling you, Tom, you were there. And he's just mesmerizing. And he gets to the point where he gets shot, and he goes into slow motion and crumples to the ground, you know, and does the whole narrative of how not only is it your worst nightmare to get wounded, but the indignity of being shot in the butt.
Yeah.
There's nothing that could convey how humiliating it was. And he could have just told us the story. Instead, he gets up, he gets his rifle, he starts to do this whole model. He was a fantastic, spellbinding storyteller. And the stories of old Hollywood. I mean, one of his first jobs in the theater was in Peter Pan, not the Mary Martin one, but the one with Gene Arthur, with Boris Karloff as Captain Hook. And he was, I said, you were in Peter Pan? No, I wasn't in it. I mean, shut up and let me finish the story. You little creep. And so we had that kind of humor where he would insult me and I would insult him. You know, I'm sorry. I lost track of what you were telling me because your head is so oversized for your body. It's like they took Mr. Ed's head and put it on a normal-sized human being. See, he loved that. He hated when you would get reverent about him or whatever. But no, one of his first jobs in the theater was being up in the balcony, and when Peter Pan would come down, Gene Arthur would, as Peter Pan would come down to the footlights, you know, and you know, do their old speech about, you can fly, you know, believe in Tinkerbell and all that. They were worried that kids, young kids, would get to, you know, because they saw kids rushing to the front of the balcony out of their seats.
Oh, to go over.
To grab them. And
his job was to grab the kids.
To be a bouncer for tiny tots up in the balcony of Peter Pan.
Lee Marvin was the catcher in the balcony ride.
It was so funny. He eventually got a job in, what's that big drama set on a boat? Billy Budd? Billy Budd, exactly. So he got like a small part in that, and I don't know if he replaced in Mr. Roberts, but I mean, he has such a legendary career, and he was just such a great guy. He had his stepdaughter over, and the wife that lasted a really, really long time. He was also going through that horrible case where she was suing for palimony, and he was over in Israel. That was going on. We didn't have instant messaging, but. You know, his agent would come over with news and so forth. It was just excruciating. Jesus, I don't want to hear about
it. I remember him seeing him on the news. I admired him so much as an actor.
Me too.
And for all the things that I admire about you, I am so jealous that you got to see Lee Marvin do that piece of theater recreating his own getting shot.
Or just watching him act on camera, because he would think it. I'm telling you, just with the shift of the eyes, I mean, he was just a masterful film actor and so generous. I mean, if you were a day player and you were telling a story, he would give you as much, he would honor you with as much attention as he would to Sam or to me or to any of the guys in the cast.
Yeah.
He was a great, loved, you know, he, in other words, it couldn't have been a better outcome for me, having been nervous that he's going to be somebody I'm afraid of, that will chew me up and spit me out and ruin his legacy mm-hmm. for me. Because that can happen. That can happen. And it was just the opposite. We stayed friends to the end. I visited him. We went down. We were still in touch with Pam, Marvin. And people say, well, do you still see the people from Star Wars? Occasionally, but it's all by accident. Big Red One and this musical, Harrigan and Hart, are both casts where we, whenever we're in town, we get together. There's barbecues. There's Christmas presents. There's, you know, if they did the restored version and showed it at Cannes, all the Four Horsemen were there. Pam Marvin was there. And you never can predict when it's going to happen. I don't really stay in touch with Gary Busey, but sometimes you bond so strongly that you can't let it go. Now, we weren't in the real military, but going through that experience in Israel and then in Ireland was so strong. We almost feel like veterans of that war.
Well, isn't the war scenes or whatever, they're always so it's really difficult. And you're sitting there in a jungle or wherever, yeah. and it's hot and everything. And everyone just looks at each other and says, can you imagine if this was real?
Oh, I know.
I mean, add to the misery we're in now with the heat and the equipment and the sweat.
Yell. I know. I thought I was going to drown. I have to jump off this boat and make it to shore in full body gear with a backpack and a rifle mm-hmm. with condoms over the muzzle. That's the way they did it. I'm telling you, you know, you're trying to swim heroic. I was trying to stay alive.
Right,
I thought
right.
I was going to drown.
Yep.
And when I got to shore, I mean, all I could do is just crumple into a heap. And yet, as you say, there's going to come a point where they go, cut, and then you have somebody that helps you with your backpack off. I mean, when you realize what those guys went through, and they were all 19, 20, 21.
It's absolutely incredible.
It is. And the chaos of the war, when you realize there's no heroics, it's just like staying alive for another 12 hours if you can.
Or the Civil War. I did a Civil War thing. And by the time you get dressed in all of the equipment and carrying the musket and all that stuff, you think, how on earth did anyone do that? And now guys are shooting at me?
Blue and the gray. Were you blue or gray?
No, I was blue.
Okay.
I was blue.
And yeah, in those days, you had to get up close to
of course.
Real people.
And they show you how to do the musket and how to ram it down and everything. And then so you're in a scene and bang, you fire it. Now you have to do all the and the gunpowder and pour it down.
I'm thinking,
people are trying to kill me right now. They're shooting at me.
No, it's unimaginable. Unimaginable. And that's what I'm saying. The experience of going through this scenario with not only Sam Fuller, whose story it was, but Lee Marvin being there to say, hey, hold it like this, don't hold it like that. I mean, he was the technical advisors. They'd been through it. And the way it demystified and deglamorized any of those sort of phony heroics garbage that you see in the movies, it was like one of the greatest experiences I've ever had. I mean, I would have loved to have worked with Lee again. And we were trying to find something that worked together. In fact, Eric Johnson wrote a screenplay about a reporter that comes to work for this grizzled old editor that was written for Lee and I, but he was getting up in years and, you know, he was getting sick and it never happened. But like I say, I mean, I don't get that many chances. I read for a pilot with Henry Fonda one time and I thought, if I open my mouth, I'm going to cry, you know, because I couldn't get over. It was too overwhelming for me. I'm sure I was terrible in the audition because I just couldn't get it over. Now, he couldn't have been nicer and more reassuring, but come on, it was Henry Fonda.
Right, right.
And so an experience like this, I mean, if I had just read for with Lee Marvin for Big Red One and I was a nobody, I mean, I'm sure they wanted to, you know, use the success I'd had as a selling point. I'm sure I wouldn't have gotten it. So, I mean, again, I'm so glad I took that meeting because it's easy to turn things down. You know, I mean, Sushi Girl, I said, this is too violent for me. I can't do this. And it turned out to be one of the more fulfilling experiences I've had in recent years. You have no telling you know, how are the other actors going to be? Are they going to be mean? Are they going to be going for me? I mean, you just don't know. The only person I knew in the whole cast was Tony Todd, and I knew his abilities. And I thought, well, if nothing else, he's got such gravitas. He's going to be great in this part. He's sort of the leader of the gangsters. And I had to meet with this young director. I mean, I don't think he'd ever directed before, maybe student films. And so that's just such a big leap of faith, and I'm nervous. It's too violent for my taste. It's not the kind of movie I would ordinarily seek out. Griffin read it. He goes, eh, come on, Dad. It's no worse than Reservoir Dogs, you know. So they put it in perspective for you. But it's these gangsters that meet after this fouled up holdup, and somebody's holding out. They think somebody's holding back the diamonds that they stole. So it winds up where, you know, they're tying guys to chairs and trying to torture information out of them. And I'm thinking, oh my God, I mean, I can't imagine myself doing this scene. And I realized I worked with Linda Blair right after she did The Exorcist. And I was like, just in awe of that movie. It just scared the bejesus out of me. And she was such a normal, giggly teenage girl. And I said, wasn't it scary on set? She goes, no. She goes, first of all, everybody was freezing because they had to keep the set refrigerated. So you'd see, it was before you could CGI all the
Sure, the steam breath. Coming out of your breath, yeah.
And I'd be in my makeup, but I couldn't see myself. I looked horrible when I got out of the makeup chair. But I'd be on the bed, and Billy, meaning William Friedkin, would make jokes about, you know how many tickets this would be at Disneyland for the bed to do all this? And, you know, they were joking. They were. It wasn't in, obviously, when they cut it all together with the music. So I should have learned from that, because I thought, how can we be doing these brutal scenes? And they're such desperate, ugly guys. I mean, my character is really not somebody that you want to bring anywhere. Psychopath, sociopath, enjoys torture. And has kind of a love for Andrew Lloyd Webber. So that was my own backstory. I said to the director, I said, if I do this, I'm going to have to really go for it. I want some really unusual look. I suggest shaving my head. Now, Mary Lou was overhearing that. She goes, you're not shaving your head. Which makes me mad, because Griffin's done it several times. You know, he doesn't ask at this point. He's old enough to make his own decisions. But I've never been completely bald, and I wanted to see what it was like. I thought, well, if I have an earring, I'm going to model them after some of the musical comedy boys that I worked with in New York. Because I just think we need some flamboyance. And plus, he was really bitchy, and he's basically the comic relief in an otherwise very grim movie, which is what appealed to me. Also, too, I said, why did you think of me? I mean, just the fact that you thought of me is flattering, because this is so atypical. You read this and you go, okay, this is Philip Seymour Hoffman, or this is Steve Buscemi. And those are the kind of parts I would really love to inherit. I'd take their casts off any day. And the guy said to me, well, because of the Joker. We thought, if you can be that insane in a cartoon, why couldn't you be that insane on camera? So that sort of motivated me to do it. But I didn't know what the look was going to be. I still didn't know what the look was. And we're going back and forth. And I thought, how about shaved widow's peak and kind of a Michael Bennett, you know, whatever, Van Dyke, something, an earring. I don't know what it is. It wasn't my idea. In fact, it was Neil Fisher, one of the producers, that did a sketch. They took a photograph of me and airbrushed out my head and did a sketch of this hairdo, which was a little too coiffed, a little too much of a bouffant. But based on that idea, I said, oh, if we want to go there, I don't know whether it's going to have to be a wig or what. As it turned out, they bleached my hair out and then put on 32 extensions. But it looks sort of like Kurt Cobain on a bad day. That's all I needed. I love when you look in the mirror and you go, well, it's not me.
Right.
I don't have to take responsibility for his behavior because it's not me. And that was a huge, huge, huge relief. So I was still scared. I mean, I love... There's something about material that scares you out of your safety zone that's the real challenge. I mean, I didn't really enjoy Elephant Man when I saw it on Broadway, where I go, oh, I can't wait to do this part. However, when they offered me the part, I auditioned for Amadeus. They'd already given a commitment to the English actor who replaced Tim Curry, although Sir Peter Hall said to me, we're not sure he's going to get his green card. A lot of times they said, oh, you did a really good job. We really want to work with you. And you take that with a grain of salt. But they put me up in a hotel to wait to see whether he could get his green card. So I knew they were serious. And when he didn't get his green card, they immediately said, we're going to honor, because we already offered it to him. but will you do Elephant Man? And I thought, well, I didn't really like the play that much. But again, when you read it and you're going to be involved, it's a whole different kettle of fish. And I jumped at the chance. But again, I said, when the scrim goes up, you're standing there in swaddling clothes, like a diaper. And not only is it scary to go out on Broadway for the first time, but when you're standing there, like pretty much in a glorified sumo outfit, it's you're so exposed. Carol Shelley had won the Tony, and she'd come back to the play. And people warned me, oh, she's murder. And, you know, it turns out she and Philip Anglim did not get along. She won the Tony. He did not. He was one of the producers. They did not have a good relationship. And I was getting the feedback from the Philip Anglim side of things. So, again, it's too late. I'm committed. I'm doing the show. I went in, and like I say, if you show good work ethic, she couldn't have been nicer. I'm telling you, Tom, I went on. They said, do you want to sneak on the Sunday performance? Because I was supposed to go on Tuesday night. I said, no, I'm not ready. I mean, I only had 3 weeks. It's a monumental role. Well, traditionally, the guys, we sneak them on the Sunday mat before they're announced, so they have one under their belt. But if you don't want to do it, I said, oh, no, I'll do it. Now, I did it. Now, it wasn't at that performance, but within the first, I don't know, 15 performances, there was a portion of the play. Now, I was in character, so when I went up, I jumped ahead like 3 pages. She cued me, and I just skipped something, and I went way
from down. Going up, people know, forget your lines.
Forget your lines. Yeah. I was so in character, I wasn't afraid because I didn't realize I'd made that mistake. Mm-hmm. She said something to me that triggered me to like 3 pages ahead, and I answered it. It was when Mrs. Kendall comes and we have an indoor picnic. Now, I had no fear. In fact, I remember later we laughed about it. I said to you at the time, I said, how could Carol make a mistake like this? Because clearly we're not doing the lines that we're supposed to be doing now. When she's done it, she not only did it and won a Tony, she went away, did something, and then they had her back after the next actress had done her 6 months and gave her a nice salary. Philip was gone by that time, and she come back. And what I realized that she was saying things like, now, John, you're clearly not yourself. I want you to calm down and take a breath. An indoor picnic's not that unusual. And I'm going, what is she talking about? What the f*** is she talking about? And she goes, now I'm going to leave this room and I'm going to forget this rather unpleasant incident. And I'm going to come in and we're going to start this picnic anew. And I went, oh? Now again, I'm in character, but when she said that, I went, I must have done something wrong. So when we got up to that point in the script, again, she gave me some. Now remember, this is when we had our prior problems. But do you know why you should be here today? And she gave me code. This is where you went up.
Yes, yes.
And I got right back on track. Now, I am so indebted to her. You know, I could kiss her feet. Again, we've stayed friends. I saw her when she was doing Wicked and I was doing 6 dance lessons. She's a friend for life. I adore her. And if I'd listened to people, say I had listened to people, I said, who needs working with a diva that's going to make your life a living hell? Right. But that's another good life lesson, is don't take other people's word for it. I mean, yeah, you're going to meet the occasional bad apple that's not fun to work with, but find out for yourself. Don't go on other people's.
Yeah.
And that's what I should say about Lee Marvin. He was everything you wanted him to be and then some, because not only was fabulous at what he did, and that's maybe why he was so secure. He knew what he was, and he was that and nothing more. He used to tell a story where he'd say, because I said, weren't you self-conscious when you did the Iceman Cometh for that theater on film series that they did in the early 70s? I mean, Jason Robards, come on. He won a Tony, and it was his role. And he went, fuck him. I said, because again, he would do the extreme to get the reaction out.
Yeah.
Not that he had disrespect for Jason Robards. But he goes, it's like when they ask who should play the part. You know what you should say? And I go, what? He goes, I know who should play this part. Who's that guy? Oh, gosh. He works all the time. He's always good, but who is it? Me, asshole! Me! And so, you know, his message was, instead of being self-conscious over taking over a role that's so associated with Jason Robards, now's his chance. He did the play. He got a Tony for it. If they're going to come to me and let me play a part like that, it's my time. So he was so wonderfully unsentimental about things. And as you can imagine, with his stories about Brando and doing Twilight Zone and just the Hellraiser that he was, I mean, those were the days where it was considered fun to go out after work, really get drunk, and then have a fist fight. Can you imagine? I mean, it's so out of my wheelhouse. I can't imagine that. I mean, I hate confrontation. And yet, you know, that was in the days when he'd be hanging out with Neville Brand and all these tough guys. I mean, Neville was a Marine. I worked with him, too. Tough, you know, the opposite of what people think a pampered actor would be. And again, their life experience was so dire where if you could get through a war and not get killed, you know, Hollywood was pretty tame in comparison.
Yeah.
But again, when he laughed, because I said, you know, when you won the Oscar, I can't remember now, but I mean, every other, it was like Richard Burton, Peter O'Toole, Sir John Gielgud, Paul Scofield. I mean, it was all these in 65. I can't remember. It was probably Line in Winter and, you know, these English dramas with all these legendary English actors. And he slips through. I mean, not that he didn't deserve it, but comedy rarely wins.
Right, right.
Comedy movies are not given their full value. Comedic performances are not. And for him to win, who knows, maybe Peter O'Toole canceled out Richard Burton. He didn't give a shit. Yeah. He won. Yeah. Now, if you remember, when he got up, he said, there's a horse out in Fernando Valley that earns, that deserves a lot of this. Because, you know, he had that horse where he'd give him a kick and the horse was taught to stumble as if it were drunk as well.
Right, right.
But, boy, I loved him. No apologies, no sentimentality. And like I say, not only infinitely entertaining on his own, but full, more than fully accepting of turning the spotlight over to whoever, not just me, but anybody else. But he particularly loved hanging with me because I could key into his sense of humor.
Right. Right.
And when, you know, tourists would come up to him and so forth, I go, no, come on, Lee, don't be mean. You, the last guy that asked for an autograph, you did that speech from Dirty Dozen. Why don't you do it for
him?
You did
a Dirty Dozen
speech. Oh, yeah. So I'd lie and make like he was being extra. And, you know, he'd grab himself and he just loved laughing.
Now, I got to let you go. You've been very, very generous with your time. I had one question. About the position that I'm in and that I kid you about, that you, of course, within the popular culture, you are a galaxy and I am the planet Beners.
No. But I know exactly what you're talking about, but the Back to the Future freaks are just as zealous.
Well, that's true.
As our fans.
So
are.
I wonder, within this perfect storm of popular culture that both of us have been involved with to varying degrees, have you gleaned any wisdom from it?
I'd like to think so. In terms of putting things into perspective in your life?
I hope so. I think so, yeah.
Yeah, because, look, just practically speaking, I haven't been involved creatively since the early 80s. So you have to force yourself to detach emotionally from that project. As much as I loved it, as much as I love those people involved, part of me gets angry that people don't get the fact that it's our job to finish the job, tuck it under, and get on to the next thing. You know, I mean, I in a way I get it, because you can apply it to other things. I mean, it's like when I met George Harrison. Now I can understand if somebody's shaking because they just can't deal with meeting me.
Right.
You understand. Not that I'm saying I'm anywhere near what George Harrison was, but I do get where it fits in the pop culture firmament. But part of me feels like what's different about our experience is it's not like they did a second trilogy of Back to the Future films with an all-new cast. And I feel like I'm pulling that baggage, too. They want to know what I thought of the prequels, and do you think Ewan McGregor does a good Alec Guinness? I mean, it's part of me, one of the things, even when I was making the movies, at that time they were going to do two other trilogies. It was going to be 9 films instead of 6. I remember back in the day saying, when they get to the next trilogy, I'm going to be one of those guys that is never going to bother them. I won't come on set unless they invite me. I won't comment on it because nothing would be worse than having, say, well, in my day, blah, blah, blah. It should be approached as a brand new project that has nothing to do with what came before. And I'm going to give them that full reign of what they would need. Because I would project, what if I were going to be in the second trilogy and there was this other one before me? But, you know, it's a funny thing because as actors, we're so trained to give the people what they want. It's sometimes you feel like you're a politician because you're always shaking hands or kissing babies or posing for photographs. You know, if you're late for a plane, you're going to get recognized. If you're dying for a table in a restaurant because you got theater tickets, no one's going to recognize you. I mean, it's always the reverse of what you want it to be. But I do know that when you meet these people and you realize what it means to them, it's humbling. It really, really is. And a lot of times you go, well, what if I had not done? I mean, if Texas Wheelers had been a hit show, I wouldn't have been able to do George's movie because it would have been our third season. And there's no way they were going to let you out to do a movie. They just didn't do that in those days. How different my career would have been. And everyone sort of, it's just human nature to contemplate the road not taken. What if I hadn't married that girl? What if I went to that college instead of this college? What if I had gone into the Navy? Whatever it is, it's human nature to wonder what, you know, it's that whole Christmas Carol thing where, you know, everyone wonders what a do-over in life would
right,
be like.
Right.
You know, would you go back knowing what you know then and change anything? And I honestly would say no, because if Twilight Zone taught us anything, is that you don't change the past because of the reverberations of the future. I am so happy with my family life. I've been married to the same woman for 32 years. We're still in love. We have family that we love. I mean, you know, I guess I'm grateful for what I have rather than anxious for something that I don't have. And like I say, I have, and there's, it's funny that things that please me that people think are, that they think shouldn't be important. I love the fact that I wrote a comic book because I loved comic books all my life, wondered what it was like, and to live that with deadlines and the responsibility, every little thing I get to do. I mean, it's crazy. Most people would think, well, compared to a movie star, doing a cartoon voice, that's slumming, you know. That's just like couch money, you know. But to me, the legacy of the Joker is so important. Now, if I hadn't been a comic book nerd and hadn't loved Batman comics when I was a kid and watched the Adam West and Cesar Romero version and then Jack Nicholson and all of it, to me, the fact that I was able, and I got it on audition, remember, they didn't say, oh, let's get Mark Hamill for this part. But I was dying to be a part of what I knew was going to be a really good take on Batman because they were doing 65 episodes and they were modeling them after the Max Fleischer Superman cartoons. In fact, they gave me a part in the first Mr. Freeze. They let me play the guy that pushes Mr. Freeze into the solution. He was sort of a phony Donald Trump type, real two-faced guy where, you know, no pun intended, but he was, hypocritical where he had a public persona and then he was an SOB behind the scenes. Now, I wasn't Mr. Freeze. I said to my agent, oh, I want to be Mr. Freeze. Well, it's take it or leave it. They're just giving you the part. You don't have to audition. Because they would put celebrities in. Now, I went over there and peppered them with so many questions. They were so taken aback with my knowledge of the Batman mythology. Are you going to do Dr. Hugo Strange? Are you going to do Clayface? Are you going to do characters that weren't in the movie? Are you going to do ones that don't have villains in it? Because he's a detective. Don't forget, he's a detective. Relax, Mark. That when they decided to change the actor that was playing the Joker, and that's it. I had to revoice six episodes because they changed their minds. They invited me to audition. I said, oh, sure. Now, with no thought of ever getting the part, I went in there and did it based on just one little black and white drawing. Eventually, when I got the part, I had to dub, like, ADR the episodes that had been finished. When I got to the cast, when I my seventh or eighth episode, whatever it was, where I was up to speed and I was with the whole cast, oh, it was a dream come true. It was like being on a radio play. And I'm a fanboy. I mean, I just loved it. And to me, see, that's really important. It's all how you approach whatever it is you're doing. Even when I was doing Wing Commander, I go, okay, it's not a feature film, but can you imagine what this is like? I mean, I could see the end product where you get to decide how the actors reacted. It's like those books. If you want them to go to the attic, turn to page 37.
Right.
If you
right.
want them to go back to the car, turn to this page. So once you and I sat with Chris Roberts, and once I got what we were doing, I love the idea of it so much because it was untrod territory. I mean,
we were in the first live action video
that I
game.
Remember. I mean, yeah. If there was one before, I don't remember it. So just the novelty of it all really pleased me. And like I say, after all these years, the things I loved as a kid, whether it's games or comic books or cartoons, the fact that they're paying me money this late in the game to do the things that I love so much as a kid, it's just pinch me. You know, now, if I'd come out of Star Wars thinking, well, now I'm Tom Cruise. Now I'm going to do $100 million movies that are all about me. Maybe I would have been really unhappy. But when I came out of Star Wars, I'm said, the script's the thing. If they offer me good movie scripts, I'll do good movie scripts. As it turned out, I went to Broadway because that was a chance to play The Elephant Man and Amadeus and Room Service, Harrigan and Hart, all these things. And I really wanted to do theater. To me, that was, you know, the way I was raised. And when I went to drama school, you know, they sort of poo-pooed movies and TV anyway. I'd still love to do a good three-camera comedy. I'll tell you one show where I looked at it and said, oh, if I could play Phil Hartman's part. News Radio. Because mm-hmm. not only was he fantastic in a role that was tailored to him, but there were so many other good people. There was Dave Foley, and there was Andy Dick, and there was Mara Tierney, all of those, what's her name, the redheaded actress, just wonderful. I love great ensemble. When I did Room Service on Broadway, Alan Arkin directed. He had all of his Second City buddies in it, and I was in hog heaven because even the guy that played the waiter was a skilled improv veteran,
mm-hmm.
and I learned so much. Eugene Trubnik was in it, and just top to bottom. I go home from a performance. I tried to rush home from downtown because it was off Broadway. It was back in when the Roundabout was downtown because I had to be home by 5:30 for Car 54, Where Are You, which was on Nickelodeon those days. And that was the only series I remember. When it was canceled, I was 10 years old, and I cried. I cried. My parents said, why are you crying?
Car 54 got canceled.
That was another one. Oh, Sue, where did we go wrong moments? Because I love Sergeant Bilko so much, and I knew the pedigree that it was the same people that did it, a lot of the same actors. And I rush home from a performance, and there's the guy, Eugene Trubnik, who's playing my brother-in-law in an episode of Car 54, Where Are You? Now, of course, he's blown away that I come back for the Tuesday night show and go, Gene, I taped you on Car 54. I did a lot of things in those. I mean, because to me, it was like such a legendary show to work with Nat Hiken and Fred Gwynne and Joey Ross, all those people. Beatrice Pons as Gunther Tootie's wife is one of the greatest comedic actors I've ever seen in my life. She comes out of the Yiddish theater.
Mm-hmm.
But that voice, Charlotte Ray, Al Lewis, I mean, I loved those New York character people so much. So, to come full circle, I think you put it in perspective, you realize how much people have gotten out of it over the years, even though it's not my thing anymore. I mean, I went and saw all the prequels and so forth, but I'm so out of the demographic. I'm sort of like in awe of all the technical advances they've made, but it didn't speak to me. It didn't sing to me. It wasn't like... I remember thinking I was disappointed in the third script in my own trilogy. So, I mean, I was sort of like getting antsy then. I loved Empire so much because it was such a shock and really challenged the audience. I thought the wrap-up was kind of pat and simplistic and so forth. But because, I mean, I had my expectations raised so high by Empire. But we were ready to go. I mean, we had a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's over, fine, and goodbye. But the legacy is bothering me. And, I mean, the fact that... you're trapped by the memorabilia people. If I try and go out and, go to a premiere or something, they're not the fans. The dealers that have 16 posters and 150 stills. And
I can't imagine them. Because
you are trapped. It's like being... I don't want to make another Beatles analogy because it sounds too big-headed. It's like being in the Monkees.
Right.
Now, Mickey Dolan still to this day is facing signing Monkey's lunchboxes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You have to balance that out. Again, the fans I love, the dealers have made it so brutal because it's such an ongoing enterprise that, you know, that I remember we signed for all these dealers when I went to see the Hulk at Universal City. We drove back over the hill and Nathan got on the computer and goes, "Hey, Dad, that piece you signed's already on eBay." So you become aiding and abetting dealers that gouge the fans.
Right, right.
And I've never charged on the street. Now, I've done shows where you're selling your autograph occasionally. Usually when I'm selling something, I don't go just to do that. I always have a product that's coming out, whether it was Wing Commander or whatever, to have something new, to have something, you know, Sushi Girl can justify, okay, I can do a fan appearance as long as we show clips from Sushi Girl during the show and give out the cards. But the way it has trapped you, it never goes away.
But people don't realize, I think, that, again, I'm small compared to your magnitude, but the guy who shows up with three shopping bags filled with material, model DeLoreans and things, and a stack of 50 photographs copied off
of
the internet.
And he's trying to sell you a line, don't put it to anyone I'm not sure I'm going to give it to. It's a gift. Like, really? Shouldn't I just put best wishes eBay? And in fact, don't diminish your role, because not only was Biff so crucial in those movies, in what function he served. Think about the people that do these Star Wars conventions that had a mask on. I mean, not even Darth Vader, a guy that was like the calamari man. You know, the guy that had a lobster mask on.
Exactly, Mark.
And he was on for 25 seconds. They're on the circuit. I mean, all those people. There's a girl that was the model for Luke's wife in a novel. I said, fine, they finally get me a girlfriend now that the movie's wrapped. But in this novel, she plays Mara Jade. I guess Luke is married with children now. I don't really know. Again, I don't follow the aftermath of it all. She's on the circuit. Oh, yes.
And she was on the cover of a book?
She was the model for the painting of the book.
The model for the painting of the cover of a book.
If she's listening to this podcast, Mazel Tov, more power to you.
Yes, but that is.
I'm just saying, that compared to some of the people that make a living doing Star Wars conventions, you're way up there. I mean, you're a major character. It was like, I mean, if in Back to the Future, the guy that sold Marty a milkshake that you said, you know, that'll be $10.50, and that was his part, and yet he's still doing this. That's what I'm making the comparison.
Yeah, yeah.
You just realize what a huge legacy that you just sort of fell into by accident. Because I thought, you know, it's got to go away at some point. And George doesn't help by going back and tweaking him like that. And again, I always defer to him saying, you know what, they're his movies, he owns them, let him do what he wants. But it's still very unsettling because it's unprecedented that the person that did them, it's not like going back and colorizing Casablanca. It's like the guy who actually was the one who deserves to do it keeps going back and changing things and putting in. I mean, I've heard now they're going to go back and take out that fabulous Stuart Freeborn sculpted puppet and Frank Oz's brilliant portrayal and put a CGI Yoda in. Now, this at this point is speculation. I don't know if it's true. Somebody told me that. I went to a thing for Sushi Girl, and a fan asked me, is that true? I said, where did you read it? And they said, it was on the internet. I said, well, then don't go by that. I know he's doing them. He's tweaking them for 3D now, and I hope he's not also doing that. Because, you know, I didn't want to go back and see the special editions. My kids said, but we never seen him in the theater. So we went. And again, I'm of a mind where part of their charm is how dated they are, you know? I mean, it's like, you don't want to go back with a silent movie and dub in dialogue. It just would be terrible.
Right, right.
And one last thing, we'll leave this behind, but that same person that said that they're going to replace the puppet with the CGI said, for consistency's value, they're going to have Ewan McGregor go back and redub Alec Guinness. Now, I said, first of all, that cannot be true. He's not only is he an Oscar-winning actor who's one of the greatest cinematic actors in history, but he was Oscar nominated for that role. It would be a desecration, and I'm sure that that's not true. Now, I'm hoping against hope that that is not true, because all these years I've been good about not popping off about what I don't like and what I like.
Sure.
You know, it's really none of my business at this point. But if that's true, if he does that, with Guinness. I don't know how more. I've tried to be as diplomatic as I can be, but I can't lie. If he does that, I'll be very, 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 very disappointed. And again, what's it to me? I mean, like I say, because my son is more of a fan than I am. Not Griffin, but Nathan.
Mm-hmm.
He was really
He loves the movies.
Yes,
and
he loves all the ephemera. And he, you know, he was the one that said, now they change it so Greedo shoots first. I go, what are you talking about? Well, that scene with Han Solo and Greedo. Part of what makes the Han Solo character instantly identifiable, that they do go under the table, he takes out the gun, and it goes against the code of the old cinematic West anyway, and he just blows this guy away.
Right.
Everybody loves it. And it tells you in a nutshell exactly who the Han Solo character is. So for them to tweak it now, where Greedo shoots first, I said, that really is messing with the legacy. Another one, did you know this? The script was written. I discussed it with Irvin Kershner. It's clear from the script, although I haven't gone back to confirm this. But when it comes to the point where Vader's cut off my hand and says, join me, and I would rather die than join him, I get really calm and I just let go. It's committing suicide, isn't
mm-hmm.
it? It's not that I scream or do anything.
Right.
I just let go. And for 2 years, they've taken it out since, but for 2.5, 3 years, I didn't believe it until I was over at somebody's apartment and I said, you're lying. They put it on. They dubbed a scream on the... Ah! Now, George didn't tell me he was going to do it. Someone said, what do you want to know was, did you dub that scream? And I said, you know, no, not only did I not know about it until it was already after the fact, but I can't tell whether he had a library of enough material where he could just pull a scream or he just had an actor do it. But George can be naughty. I mean, he didn't tell Suzanne Summers that he was going to dub her voice in American Graffiti, and she didn't find out till she saw it in the screening and said, that's not my voice. And it really, really hurt her feelings.
Yeah.
Now, you and I would know, because we're actors ourselves, that what you do is you ask her to dinner or give her a phone call and say, you know what, I'm really apologetic about this, but just the way things have worked out, your voice is too kind, your voice is, I mean, I want it, whatever it is.
Right.
But you give them a heads up before they go to... But George is so technical, you know, that to me, I can understand why he wouldn't think it was important to the actor to even tell him.
And the funny part is that I understand how huge that is, as do you, as does any actor. The difference between just surrendering and screaming.
Yes. Because if you're
changes the entire end of the scene.
Go, of course. And it goes against the wishes of the script, the director, Irvin Kershner, and the performer, me. And just to arbitrarily decide he's going to do that, I mean, I'm thinking, boy, this guy needs to get out more because, I mean, you think I got trapped. He is so removed from everyday. I mean, I remember when I visited him editing the first one and I'm watching on the movie, and I go, hey, George, this is getting kind of boring. Let's go get a root beer float at A&W. You know, yeah, why not? And we get in his truck and drive down. Get a cheeseburger and a root beer float. And he goes, yeah, I'm going to get it back because, you know, I don't want to stay up too late. People marvel when I tell that story because now you'd have to make an appointment to make an appointment to meet his assistant to his assistant.
Yes.
And you wouldn't get as far as the editing room.
Yes. You have to meet Gina. Gina then talks to Rick.
Yeah. Rick will say, well, how's Thursday at 9:45? Right. And you'll believe me, I'm not telling tales out of school because I love George. But what I'm saying is once you get so isolated from the everyday life that most of us lead, it's not hard to understand why he loses perspective. You know, I've told the story that he wanted to cut the kiss, you know, which gets a big laugh. Well, just before he swing across with the princess, she goes, the sequence, but she goes, either for luck and then kiss me or gives me a kiss and I react and she goes, for luck, and then off we go.
Yeah.
Well, in the test screenings, I always got a laugh. And so he cut it. And Marcia, his wife at the time, said, why'd you cut that? He goes, well, I was getting that laugh. She goes, of course. It's a release. It's so out of nowhere. It's so cornball in the modern day sensibility that it's a legitimate laugh.
Right.
George thought they were laughing at us rather than with us.
Or just, I love you, I know.
Okay.
That just gets a laugh.
Of course. And Marcia talked him into reinstating that. And I said, that illustrates what happened when they broke up, because Marcia was the real heart of that duo. George is more of a technocrat and more removed emotionally. And Marcia loved to go dancing and smoke and drink wine and so forth. And George was the opposite. So, I mean, that happens. I mean, you know, it's a family. When George fired Gary Kurtz after the Empire went over budget, and George wasn't happy about it. And not only did he get rid of his longtime partner back to American Graffiti, it was like a divorce in the family. We weren't allowed to talk about it. We couldn't say, oh, what happened to Gary? Mm-hmm. We miss Gary. And, you know, it was one of those things where it was just understood that you don't go against the boss. And if it's his decision to get rid of somebody that was so much a part of those movies from the very day one all the way through the first two is now gone. Again, I still haven't reconciled myself to it, because if he was mad that it went over budget with all the technical problems with Yoda and all of that, he's family and you work it out. But, you know, like I say, part of me says you can't change things you have no control over, which is why you just have to reconcile yourself to the fact that for George, he just never lets them go. I said, do another trilogy. Don't keep tweaking the old ones. But that's not what he wants mm-hmm. to do. So I sort of live in my own bubble of reality, you know. And as I'm sure you are, you're sort of taken aback when all of a sudden there's a big rush of people going, oh, my God, you're Biff from Back to the Future. Mm. Oh, yeah, I was just trying to get my plane. You know, I've
got exactly.
a gig to get to. You know, don't forget that. I mean, when we have trick-or-treaters, it's the parents that are all excited about me coming in the door, not the 4- and 5-year-olds. They, yeah. To me, they have no idea who I am. I'm sure I said, just tell them I'm Luke's grandfather. It'll be a lot more, less yes. traumatic for them.
Yes.
You know, because I remember seeing Burt Lahr on the Mike Douglas show and thinking, what happened to the Cowardly Lion? Well, he's 78, you moron.
Well, the bunch of kids who came to my house when we moved in, right. and the team of kids, 6 or 7 little kids, right. knock on the door. I answered the door. I said, you know, whatever. My mom said that you were an actor and you were in Back to the Future. Is that true?
Yeah.
I said, well, yes, that's true. I swear. They said, why do you live here?
Yeah, because
but you should have a movie. You should be a movie star. You should have a mansion or something.
Of course. I mean, even
it's just a house.
People that should know better. I mean, I had the Sushi Girl cast come over and they go, this is a really nice little house. And they said, we thought we, you know, take acres to get to your front door.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm living.
You get in the tram or something.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, that's another thing that's hard to reconcile is people's idea of what you should be rather than what you are. Yeah.
Well, but I'll tell you,
it's all better than a poke in the eye with a sharp stick.
It
That's
certainly
what I
is.
Say.
And for an actor of your incredible experience, but that was struck by a partially golden, partially black, partially multicolored tornado yeah. in your life. Very few, Mark, have dealt with it with the kindness and the grace, the professionalism, and the good spirit that you have.
Well, so. Because you can't forget your audience. Yes, it's frustrating. Yes, it's a pain in the ass. But that 45 seconds to a minute and a half is all the time they're going to ever have with you. And I can't tell you how many people I've met that are crushing disappointments because they're rude or condescending or blow you off. Usually the people that have no right to do it.
Right.
And yet it sounds cornball because, oh, I love my fans. But I really do have a connection with them. I really so identify with how I was as a kid. I mean, if you'd ever told me you're going to meet two Beatles in your life, I would not have believed it. And secondly, I wouldn't have been able to anticipate how I would handle an encounter like that. So, you know, again, you have to put it in perspective with your own life experience. So, you know, I get real self-conscious because I'm not as young as I was. I can never be whatever it was, because it's so idealized and so, you know, of the stuff of movies. But I've never sort of given into being – it's always a challenge to try and find another project that you like and want to commit yourself to as much as something that people don't realize that you've left behind for so many years. Again, I try and be true. I looked at the Clone Wars on the air because so many of my friends in voiceover are on
sure.
it.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't really hold my interest. I don't have small children anymore. If Nathan was back in junior high school, we'd probably be recording every episode.
Mm-hmm.
But he, again, I mean, I'm proud of him. He's worked at Matt Groening's comic book company for 8 years. If you pick up Bart Simpson or The Simpsons or Futurama, he's a colorist and a writer. And just to have a son that's a professional comic book guy, that to me is, you know, I love that. I love that Griffin is artistically inclined. And hell, Chelsea just graduated from USC magna cum laude, which is nothing. I'm sure she got it from her mother, who was a dental hygienist. I was never academically that gifted. It's I think being satisfied with what you have, being rather than being, you know, envious or covetous of what somebody else has. And really, to tell you the truth, I mean, there's not a lot of movies and plays I like, and of those, there are even fewer that have anything that are right for me in it.
Right, now, I might sure.
By process of elimination, and like I say, if you have a goal that you're always trying to accomplish, which is right now we're close to, and I'm hoping we can seal the deal to make a Black Pearl a movie. I just want to get that done. I mean, I remember in one pitch I vowed, I said, if you can fund this, I will sign an affidavit and guarantee you that I will retire from show business if you'll just fund this movie. This is the last thing I want to do, and then I'll quit forever. Uh-huh.
So if anyone really wants to get rid of you,
yes,
yeah,
fund
finance
this movie,
the movie, and you'll
get rid of
gone.
Me forever. Well, think about it, because once you get into this gray area of where you're not bankable, but you're not like a TV star or anything, most of the offers you get are, you know, get me out of here, I'm a celebrity. Or I've been offered reality shows where, you know, I would have to let camera crews come in and film my family, or celebrity rehab, you know. Well, let me think. I am sort of addicted to TV. Does that count? But again, I mean, if I've got, that's not the reason I got into show business. It's not because I want to be recognized or, you know, sort of idolized in any way. It's just because I love doing fun things that I did as a kid. I mean, in voiceover, especially, Rob Paulson says all the time, you know, I'm getting paid for what I used to get thrown out of class
right.
for by talking in an Elmer Fudd voice or whatever. So, I mean, I love actors. I love the whole business we call show. I can never imagine being a 9-to-5er sitting at a desk. It would drive me crazy. You know, I mean, I'm a sort of a political junkie. I love watching politicians and following but I could never do it. That's what I want to do. I want to play a politician rather than do what Al Franken did and actually go for it and run for something.
Right.
But
well, listen, the sky is dark. From one immortal, brilliant pop icon to another. Thanks so much.
One of the things I love, and I'll never forget about you, Tom, is when within the first hour or two of meeting you, and it's probably what I used with Lee Marvin, you were talking about something and parenthetically just shout out, by the way, my ride's way better than your ride. It leveled me because, first of all, I knew you were joking, and the idea that that would be something that you would consider
a competition with you. Yeah.
Of course. And assuming that feature films routinely become amusement park rides.
Of course.
And by the way, you know, when I was doing Sequest, Roy Scheider's wife came on set, and Mary Lou was there. And he goes, you know, if we have time, you want to go on the Back to the Future ride? I said, I would love to, because I never have. And I worked with Tom Wilson. I mean, he used to tell me how much better his ride was.
I
also want to know if it's true. We were like kids, because it was like 6:45. They had radioed that Roy Scheider was coming over, but we were running like teenagers. Ran over because they were shooting. We were shooting right, you know, near the park, and we went over. We went on the Back to the Future. We just loved it. We had the time of our lives. And when it was over, I said, "Look, it's only just 5 minutes till closing, Roy. Give me such pleasure. Let's go on the Jaws ride. And if you could sit very stiffly during the ride, and then break out of it and freak people out." I couldn't talk him into it, but I was this close to being able to go on the Jaws ride with Roy Scheider. Now, I don't know how long your podcasts are. This sounds like a mini-series.
It is.
You're going to have to put it on over five nights.
In fact, I'm going to get a small beverage and then come back and then start.
Also, too, you can go back and cut all the boring parts out.
Of course.
But I'll tell you,
it's tough pulling stuff out of you.
Oh, I know. I'm such a shrinking violet.
It's tough to get you to talk, to open up. Thanks so much, buddy. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
I was talking to Mark at his house. It was getting dark. We were at a place at his house that didn't have a lot of lamps, so we were there in the shadows as the Pacific Ocean darkened and the sun set across the hills. And it was a very beautiful scene, and it was great to talk to Mark. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks to Emily Wilson for producing. Thanks to Chris and Katie, everybody over at Nerdist, for helping me out. Thanks to McPherson Guitars and Dean Markley Strings for helping me out. But thanks, as always, I thank you for listening. Thanks very much. Consider, telling a friend about it. Consider subscribing. But keep listening. I hope you're having fun. Bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.